27% of the winners from the first period ended up in the bottom quintile, and another 25% landed in the next-to-last, fourth quintile. Even worse, 10% of the previous winners didn't even survive the next 5 years. At the other end of the spectrum, 17% of the first-period laggards ended up at the top of the heap in the subsequent period, even better than the first-period winners, and only 12% of the losers repeated their dismal performance in the second period, while 26% didn't survive. You need not be a statistical wizard to observe the remarkable randomness of returns through each of the quintiles, with steady RTM centering around 16% in each quintile, less than the 20% we started with in the first period. This lower number is because fully 18% of the funds from the first period went out of business before the second period ended, presumably due to poor performance. A second study reaffirms the first study with incredible precision. You might be wondering if this pattern was just a one-time event, not likely to be repeated. I had the same question. So we looked at the preceding non-overlapping 5-year period, 2001 to 2006, and 2006 to 2011. The pattern held. Please refer to Exhibit 11.2 in the accompanying PDF. Of the top quintile winners from 2001 to 2006, only 15% remained in the top quintile, while 20% fell to the bottom. Even worse, 13% of the funds, 45 funds, failed to survive. Among the bottom quintile laggards from 2001 to 2006, 18% ended the subsequent period in the top quintile. Once again, even better than the first period's winners, only 15% of which maintained their position at the top. Only 6% of the lowest-ranking funds repeated their dismal performance. 152 of the bottom quintile funds, 43%, did not survive. Just glance over the data in these two exhibits and you will see the recurring pattern of RTM. Like the results in Exhibit 11.1, the second period results are essentially random. The vast majority of the funds in all five quintiles earned subsequent returns that were largely spread relatively equally over each performance quintile, between 13% and 18% in each. From these data, we can conclude that RTM exerts a powerful force on mutual fund returns. There is remarkably little persistence in returns among the top and bottom funds alike. I don't amaze easily, but these data are truly amazing. They dramatically belie the assumption of most investors and advisors that manager's skill will persist. Most investors seem to believe that manager's skill will persist, but it doesn't. We are Fooled by Randomness, the title of a provocative book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. The stars produced in the mutual fund field rarely remain stars. All too often, they become meteors. The message is clear. Reversion to the mean, RTM, the tendency of funds whose records substantially exceed industry norms to return toward the average or below, is alive and well in the mutual fund industry. In stock market blow-offs, the first shall be last. But in more typical environments, reversion to the fund mean is the rule. So please remember that the stars produced in the mutual fund field are rarely stars. All too often they are meteors, lighting up the firmament for a brief moment in time, and then flaming out, their ashes floating gently to earth. With each passing year, the reality is increasingly clear. Relative returns of mutual funds are random. Yes, there are rare cases where skill seems to be involved, but it would require decades to determine how much of a fund's success can be attributed to luck and how much attributed to skill. If you disagree and decide to invest in a fund with superior recent performance, you might ask yourself questions like these. 1. How long will the fund manager, with the same staff and with the same strategy, remain on the job? 2. If the fund's assets grow many times larger, will the same results that were achieved when the fund was small be sustained when it is large? 3. To what extent did high expense ratios and/or high portfolio turnover detract from the fund's performance? Or did low expenses and low turnover enhance performance? 4. Will the stock market continue to favor the same kinds of stocks that have been at the heart of the manager's style? Picking winning funds based on past performance is hazardous duty. In short, selecting mutual funds on the basis of recent performance is all too likely to be hazardous duty, and it is almost always destined to produce returns that fall far short of those achieved by the stock market, itself so easily achievable through an index fund. It might help our understanding if we each ask ourselves just why it is so hard to recognize the powerful principle of reversion to the mean that punctuates not only mutual funds returns, but almost every corner of our lives. In his 2013 book, Thinking, Fast and Slow, here's how Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman answered that question. Our mind is strongly biased toward causal explanations and does not deal well with mere statistics. When our attention is called to an event, associative memory will look for its cause, but they, causal explanations, will be wrong, because the truth is that regression to the mean has an explanation, but does not have a cause. Don't take my word for it. As this book was about to go to press, The Economist commentator Buttonwood struck almost precisely the same note as this chapter. Suppose you had picked one of the best-performing 25% of American equity mutual funds in the 12 months to March 2013. In the subsequent 12 months to March 2014, only 25.6% of those funds stayed in the top quartile. That result is no better than chance. In the subsequent 12-month periods, this elite bunch is winnowed down to 4.1%, 0.5%, and 0.3%. All figures that are worse than chance would predict. Similar results apply if you had picked one of the best-performing 50% of all funds. Those in the upper half of the charts failed to stay there. Suppose you had picked a fund with a top-quartile performance in the 5 years to March 2012. What proportion of those funds would be in the top quartile over the subsequent 5 years to March 2017? The answer is just 22.4%. Again, less than chance would suggest. Indeed, 27.6% of the star funds in the 5 years to March 2012 were in the worst performing quartile in the 5 years to March 2017. Investors had a higher chance of picking a dud than a winner. The old saying that past performance is no guide to the future is not a piece of compliance jargon. It is the math. Listen to Nassim Nicholas Taleb, author of Fooled by Randomness. Toss a coin, heads, and the manager will make $10,000 over the year, tails, and he will lose $10,000. We run the contest for the first year for 10,000 managers. At the end of the year, we expect 5,000 managers to be up $10,000 each and 5,000 to be down $10,000. Now we run the game a second year. Again, we can expect 2,500 managers to be up 2 years in a row. Another year, 1,250. A fourth one, 625. A fifth, 313. We have now, simply in a fair game, 313 managers who made money for 5 years in a row. In 10 years, just 10 of the original 10,000 managers, only 0.1%, will have tossed heads in each year. Out of pure luck, a population entirely composed of bad managers will produce a small amount of great track records. The number of managers with great track records in a given market depends far more on the number of people who started in the investment business, in place of going to dental school, rather than on their ability to produce profits. That may sound theoretical, so here is a practical outlook. Hear Money Magazine's colloquy with Ted Aronson, partner of respected Philadelphia investment management firm AJO. Question. You've said that investing in an actively managed fund, as opposed to a passively run index fund, is an act of faith. What do you mean? Answer. Under normal circumstances, it takes between 20 and 800 years of monitoring performance to statistically prove that a money manager is skillful, not lucky. To be 95% certain that a manager is not just lucky, it can easily take nearly a millennium, which is a lot more than most people have in mind when they say long-term. Even to be only 75% sure he's skillful, you'd generally have to track a manager's performance for between 16 and 115 years. Investors need to know how the money management business really works. It's a stacked deck. The game is unfair. Question: where do you invest? Answer: in Vanguard index funds. I've owned Vanguard Index 500 for 23 years. Once you throw in taxes, it just skewers the argument for active management. Personally, I think indexing wins hands down. After tax, active management just can't win. Finally, Wall Street Journal columnist and author Jason Zweig sums up performance chasing in a single pungent sentence. Buying funds based purely on their past performance is one of the stupidest things an investor can do. Chapter 12. Seeking advice to select funds? Look before you leap. The evidence presented in chapters 10 and 11 teaches two lessons. 1. Selecting winning equity funds over the long term offers all the potential success of finding a needle in a haystack. 2. Selecting winning funds based on their performance over relatively short-term periods in the past is all too likely to lead, if not to disaster, at least to disappointment. So why not abandon these do-it-yourself approaches and rely on professional advice? Pick a financial consultant, the designation usually given to the stockbrokers of Wall Street, and indeed brokers everywhere, or a registered investment advisor, RIA, the designation usually applied to non-brokers, who often, but not always, work on a fee-only basis rather than on a commission basis, or even an insurance agent offering investment products, such as variable annuities. Beware! Registered investment advisors, RIAs, can play a vital role in providing investors with assistance. In this chapter, I'll attempt to answer the question about the value of investment consultants. You'll note that I'm skeptical of the ability of advisors as a group to help you select equity funds that can produce superior returns for your portfolio. Some do, most do not. Professional investment advisors are best at providing other valuable services, including asset allocation guidance, information on tax considerations, and advice on how much to save while you work and how much to spend when you retire. Further, most advisors are always there to consult with you about the financial markets. Advisors can encourage you to prepare for the future. They can help you deal with many extra investment decisions that have investment implications. For example, when you want to build a fund for your children's college education, or need to raise cash for the purchase of a home. Experienced advisors can help you avoid the potholes along the investment highway. Put more grossly, they can help you to avoid making such dumb mistakes as chasing past performance, or trying to time the market, or ignoring fund costs. At their best, these important services can enhance the implementation of your investment program and improve your returns. A large majority of investors rely on brokers or advisors for help in penetrating the dense fog of complexity that, for better or worse, permeates our financial system. If the generally accepted estimate that some 70% of the 55 million American families who invest in mutual funds do so through intermediaries is correct, then about 15 million families choose the do-it-yourself road. The remaining 40 million families rely on professional helpers for investment decision-making. That's essentially the unsuccessful strategy described in my opening parable about the Gottrocks family's helpers. Helpers, adding value or subtracting value? We'll never know exactly how much value is added or subtracted by these helpers in selecting mutual funds for your portfolio. But it's hard for me to imagine that as a group, they are other than, well, average, before their fees are taken into account. That is, their advice on equity fund selection produces returns for their clients that are probably not measurably different from those of the average fund, and therefore several percentage points per year behind the stock market, as measured by the S&P 500 index. See Chapter 4. However, I'm willing to consider the possibility that the fund selections recommended by investment advisors, RIAs and brokers, may be better than average. As I explained in Chapter 5, If they merely select funds with the lowest all-in costs, hardly rocket science, they'll do better for you. If they are savvy enough to realize that high turnover funds are tax inefficient, they'll pick up important additional savings for you in transaction costs and taxes. If you put those two policies together and emphasize low-cost index funds, as so many advisors do, so much the better for the client. If you can avoid jumping on the bandwagon, and if professional investment consultants are wise enough or lucky enough to keep their clients from jumping on the latest and hottest bandwagon, for example, the tech stock craze of the late 1990s, reflected in the mania for funds investing in new economy stocks, their clients may earn returns that easily surpass the disappointing returns achieved by fund investors as a group. Remember, the additional shortfall of about 1.5 percentage points per year relative to the average equity fund that we estimated in Chapter 7? To remind you, the average nominal investor return came to just 6.3% per year during 1991 to 2016, despite a strong stock market in which a simple S&P 500 index fund earned an annual return of 9.1%. Alas, from the standpoint of the advisors, there is simply no evidence that the fund selection advice RIAs and brokers provide has produced any better returns than those achieved by fund investors on average. In fact, the evidence goes the other way. A study by a research team led by two Harvard Business School professors concluded that between 1996 and 2002, the underperformance of broker channel funds, funds managed by the salesman's employer, relative to funds sold through the direct channel, purchased directly by investors, cost investors approximately $9 billion per year. Average annual return of funds recommended by advisors, 2.9%. For equity funds purchased directly, 6.6%. Specifically, the study found that broker and advisor asset allocations were no better, that they chased market trends, and that the investors they advised paid higher upfront charges. The study's conclusion: the weighted average return of equity funds held by investors who relied on advisors, excluding all charges paid up front or at the time of redemption, averaged just 2.9% per year, compared with 6.6% earned by investors who took charge of their own affairs. This powerful evidence, however, does not bring the researchers to the clear conclusion that advice in its totality has negative value. We remain, the report states, open to the possibility that substantial intangible benefits exist, and will undertake more research to identify these intangible benefits and explore the elite group of advisors who do improve the welfare of households who trust them. The Merrill Lynch debacle, a case study. There is even more powerful evidence that the use of stockbrokers, as distinct from RIAs, has a strong negative impact on the returns earned by fund investors. In a study prepared for Fidelity Investments covering the 10-year period 1994 to 2003 inclusive, broker-managed funds had the lowest ratings relative to their peers of any group of funds. The other groups included funds operated by privately owned managers, by publicly owned managers, by managers owned by financial conglomerates, and by bank managers. In the Fidelity study, the Merrill Lynch funds were 18 percentage points below the fund industry average. The Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley funds were 9 percentage points below average. Both the Wells Fargo and Smith Barney funds were 8 percentage points behind in terms of 10-year returns. Part of the reason for this performance failure may arise from the nature of the job. The brokerage firm and its brokers, financial consultants, must sell something every single day. If they don't, they won't survive. When a brokerage firm introduces a new fund, the brokers have to sell it to someone. Imagine a day when nobody sold anything, and the stock market lay fallow, silent all day long. Two terrible ideas, the Focus 20 Fund and the Internet Strategies Fund. This powerful example illustrates the Merrill Lynch debacle, a shocking example of the destructive challenges that may be faced by investors who rely on stockbrokers. In March 2000, just as the bubble created by the internet stock craze reached its peak, Merrill Lynch, the world's largest stock brokerage firm, jumped on the bandwagon with two new funds to sell. One was a Focus 20 fund, based on the then popular theory that if a manager's 100 favorite stocks were good, surely his 20 favorites would be even better. The other was an Internet Strategies fund. The public offering of the two funds was an incredible success. Merrill's brokers pulled in $2.0 billion from their trusting, or was it performance chasing, clients. $0.9 billion in Focus 20 and $1.1 billion in Internet Strategies. A marketing success for Merrill Lynch, an investment failure for its clients. The subsequent returns of the funds, however, were an incredible failure. This was not surprising. The best time to sell a new fund to investors, when it's hot, is often the worst time to buy it. Internet Strategies tanked almost immediately. Its asset value dropped 61% during the remainder of 2000 and another 62% by October 2001. The total loss for the period was a cool 86%. Most of the fund's investors cashed out their shares at staggering losses. When the fund's original $1.1 billion of assets had plummeted to just $128 million, Merrill decided to kill Internet Strategies and give it a decent burial, merging it with another Merrill fund. Keeping a record like that alive would have been a continuing embarrassment to the firm. Investment disaster. Clients lose 80% of their assets. For what it's worth, the losses in Focus 20 were less severe. Its asset value declined 28% in the remainder of 2000, another 70% in 2001, and another 39% in 2002, before finally posting positive returns in the 3 years that followed. On balance, its cumulative lifetime return through late 2006 came to minus 79%. Investors have regularly withdrawn their capital, and the fund's assets, which had reached almost $1.5 billion in 2000, currently languish at $82 million. A 95% decline. Unlike its Internet Strategies cousin, Focus 20 soldiers on, now known as BlackRock Focus Growth. The lesson remains. The $2 billion marketing success of the Merrill Lynch Internet Strategies Fund and Focus 20 Fund resulted in an investment disaster for Merrill's clients, who lost some 80% of their hard-earned savings. The value of financial consultants. Despite their disappointing results as a group, and that example of colossal failure by brokerage firm Merrill Lynch, RIAs can add value to investors in many other ways. I endorse the idea that for many, indeed most, investors, financial advisors may provide valuable services in helping to give you peace of mind, in helping you establish a sensible portfolio that matches your appetite for reward and your tolerance for risk, in helping you deal with the complexities, nuances, and tax implications of investing in mutual funds, and in helping you stay the course in troubled seas. But the evidence I've presented so far strongly confirms my original hypothesis that, as vital as those services may be, advisors as a group cannot be credibly relied upon to add value by selecting funds that will beat the market. The rise of the robo-advisor. In recent years, a new method of providing advice to investors has developed. A number of new firms have taken advantage of record-keeping technology and offered computerized robo-advice directly to investors, often with little or no face-to-face interaction. These firms claim the advantage of tax loss harvesting, but otherwise generally have recommended buy-and-hold portfolios with asset allocation among bond and stock index funds. They typically focus on exchange-traded index funds, with their ready liquidity and absence of limits on frequent transactions, often imposed by fund managers. The growth of robo-advisors has been rapid. In 2017, the two pioneering robo-advisors report about $10 billion of client assets under management. But so far, robo-advisors represent only a tiny fraction of total investor assets served by RIAs. With annual fees that are extremely low, often around 0.25%, they may well become a significant participant in the field of advice going forward. Simplicity beats complexity. Despite being dated or anecdotal, the evidence in this chapter is an eye-opener to the challenge faced by complex investment strategies. In all, this evidence suggests that, yet again, the simplicity of a broad-market, low-cost index fund, bought and then held forever, is likely to be the optimal strategy for the vast majority of investors. If you are considering the selection of an RIA, a stockbroker, or an insurance agent to provide you with investment advice, please take heed of these findings. If you decide to go ahead, make sure you are paying a fair fee, for fees paid to advisors result in a significant deduction from whatever rate of return your fund portfolio earns. Since most investment advisory fees tend to begin in the range of 1% per year and then scale down, be sure to balance the worth of the peripheral services that advisors provide against the reduction in your returns that those fees are likely to represent over time. Finally, and this will hardly surprise you, look with particular favor on advisors who recommend stock and bond index funds in their model portfolios. The fiduciary standard. I close this chapter with good news for clients who rely on professional advice in selecting and managing their mutual fund portfolios. There is a developing trend toward establishing a federal standard of fiduciary duty for advisors. This means, simply put, that advisors are required to place your interests first. The standard approved in 2016 by the Department of Labor would apply only to firms and persons offering retirement plans to investors, such as individual retirement accounts, IRAs, 401k thrift plans, and 403b thrift plans. RIAs are already held to a fiduciary standard for all of their clients under existing law. But the application of the standard to stockbrokers and insurance agents represents a major extension to the principle, put the client first. Ultimately, the new standard must be expanded to encompass not only retirement plans, but all accounts of all clients. Yet, even now, a partisan political move is afoot to dilute or eliminate the existing standard, set to become effective in 2017. But the reality is that, even if the present proposal ultimately fails, the principle of fiduciary duty, of putting the client first, will prevail. The arc of investment is long, but it bends toward fiduciary duty. Don't take my word for it. Listen to the widely respected investment advisor William Bernstein, who wrote these words in his book, The Four Pillars of Investment Wisdom. You will want to ensure that your advisor is choosing your investments purely on their investment merit and not on the basis of how the vehicles reward him. The warning signs here are recommendations of load funds, insurance products, limited partnerships, or separate accounts. The best and only way to make sure that you and your advisor are on the same team is to make sure that he is fee only. That is, that he receives no remuneration from any other source besides you. Fee only is not without pitfalls, however. Your advisor's fees should be reasonable. It is simply not worth paying anybody more than 1% to manage your money. Above $1 million, you should be paying no more than 0.75%, and above $5 million, no more than 0.5%. Your advisor should use indexed passive stock funds wherever possible. If he tells you that he is able to find managers who can beat the indexes, he is fooling both you and himself. I refer to a commitment to passive indexing as asset class religion. Don't hire anyone without it. Chapter 13. Profit from the Majesty of Simplicity and Parsimony. Hold traditional low-cost index funds that track the stock market. What lessons have we learned in the previous chapters? Costs matter. Chapters 5, 6, and 7. Selecting equity funds based on their long-term past performance doesn't work. Chapter 10. Fund returns revert to the mean, RTM. Chapter 11. Relying even on the best-intentioned advice works only sporadically. Chapter 12. If low costs are good, and I don't think a single analyst, academic, or industry expert would disagree with the idea that low costs are good, why wouldn't it be logical to focus on the lowest cost funds of all, traditional index funds, TIFs, that own the entire stock market? Some of the largest TIFs carry annual expense ratios as low as 0.04% and incur turnover costs that approach zero. Their all-in costs, then, can come to just 4 basis points per year, 96% below even the 91 basis points for the lowest cost quartile of funds described in Chapter 5. And it works. Witness the real-world superiority of the S&P 500 Index Fund compared with the average equity fund over the past 25 years and over the previous decade, as described in earlier chapters. The case for the success of indexing in the past is compelling and unarguable. And with the outlook for subdued returns on stocks during the decade ahead, let's conclude our anecdotal stroll through the relentless rules of humble arithmetic with a final statistical example that suggests what the future may hold. The Monte Carlo simulation. We can, in fact, use statistics designed to project the odds that a passively managed index fund will outpace an actively managed equity fund over various time periods. The complex exercise is called a Monte Carlo simulation. A common Monte Carlo simulation technique takes all the monthly returns earned by stocks over a long period, even a full century, scrambles them randomly, and then computes the annual rates of return generated by each of the thousands of hypothetical portfolios. What it does is make a few simple assumptions about the volatility of equity fund returns and the extent to which they vary from the returns earned in the stock market, as well as an assumption about the all-in costs of equity investing. The particular example presented here assumes that index fund costs will run to 0.25% per year, and that the all-in costs of active management will run to 2% per year. Index funds are available at far lower costs, and many equity funds carry even higher costs. So we've given actively managed funds the benefit of a very large doubt. Result, over 1 year, about 29% of active managers, on average, would be expected to outpace the index. And over 5 years, about 15% would. After 50 years, only 2% of active managers would be expected to win. Refer to Exhibit 13.1 in the accompanying PDF. The majesty of simplicity in an empire of parsimony. How will the future actually play out? Of course, we can't be sure. But we know what the past 25 years looked like, and we saw in Chapter 10 that since 1970, only 2 of the 355 funds in business at the outset outperformed the stock market index by 2% or more per year. What's more, one of these winners lost its early edge 2 full decades ago. So it looks as if our statistical odds are in the right ballpark. This arithmetic suggests, even demands, that index funds deserve an important place in your portfolio, even as they constitute the overriding portion of my own portfolio. In the era of subdued stock and bond market returns that most likely lies in prospect, fund costs will become more important than ever, even more so when we move from the illusion that mutual funds as a group can capture whatever returns our financial markets provide to the even greater illusion that most mutual fund investors can capture even those depleted returns in their own fund portfolios. What the index fund has going for it is, as I have often said, the majesty of simplicity in an empire of parsimony. To reiterate, all those pesky costs, fund expense ratios, sales charges, turnover costs, tax costs, And the most subtle cost of all, the rising cost of living, inflation, are virtually guaranteed to erode the real spending power of our investments over time. What's more, only in the rarest cases do fund investors actually succeed in capturing the returns that the funds report. My conclusions rely on mathematical facts, the relentless rules of humble arithmetic. My conclusions about the market returns that we can expect in the years ahead may be wrong, too high or too low. But my conclusions about the share of those returns that funds will capture, and the share of those returns that we investors will actually enjoy, have one thing in common. They rely not on opinion, but largely on mathematical facts, the relentless rules of humble arithmetic, that make selecting winning funds akin to looking for a needle in a haystack. Ignore these rules at your peril. If the road to investment success is filled with dangerous turns and giant potholes, never forget that simple arithmetic can enable you to moderate those turns and avoid those potholes. So do your best to diversify to the nth degree. Minimize your investment expenses and focus your emotions where they cannot wreak the kind of havoc that most other investors experience. Rely on your own common sense. Emphasize an S&P 500 index fund or an all-stock market index fund. They're pretty much the same. Carefully consider your risk tolerance and the portion of your investments you allocate to equities. Then, stay the course. All index funds are not created equal. Costs to investors vary widely. I should add, importantly, that all index funds are not created equal. Although their index-based portfolios are substantially identical, their costs are anything but identical. Some have minuscule expense ratios. Others have expense ratios that surpass the bounds of reason. Some are no-load funds, but nearly a third, as it turns out, has substantial front-end loads, often with an option to pay those loads over a period of, usually, 5 years. Others entail the payment of a standard brokerage commission. The gap between the expense ratios charged by the low-cost funds and the high-cost funds offered by 10 major fund organizations for their S&P 500 index-based funds runs upward of an amazing 1.3% of assets per year, referred to Exhibit 13.2 in the accompanying PDF. Worse, the high-cost index funds also saddle investors with front-end sales loads. Even among the low-cost S&P 500 index funds, we see a wide range of expenses. While the Admiral class of Vanguard's index fund carries a minuscule 0.04% expense ratio, the T. Rowe Price Fund charges 0.25%. Although lower than the high-cost index funds, that T. Rowe Price Fund is hardly low. Assuming an annual return of 6%, compounded over 25 years, an initial investment of $10,000 would grow to $40,458 in the T. Rowe Price Index Fund. With a truly low-cost index fund carrying an expense ratio of 0.04%, that $10,000 investment would grow to $42,516, an increase of $2,058 over the higher-cost index fund. Yes, even seemingly small differences in costs matter. Today, there are some 40 traditional index mutual funds designed to track the S&P 500 index, 14 of which carry front-end loads ranging between 1.5% and 5.75%. The wise investor will select only those index funds that are available without sales loads and those operating with the lowest costs. These costs, no surprise here, directly relate to the net returns delivered to the shareholders of these funds. Two funds, one index, different costs. The first index fund was created by Vanguard in 1975. It took 9 years before the second index fund appeared. Wells Fargo Equity Index Fund, formed in January 1984. Its subsequent return can be compared with that of the original Vanguard 500 index fund since then. Both funds selected the S&P 500 index as their benchmark. The sales commission on the Vanguard Index 500 fund was eliminated within months of its initial offering, and it now operates with an expense ratio of 0.04%, 4 basis points, for investors who have $10,000 or more invested in the fund. In contrast, the Wells Fargo fund carried an initial sales charge of 5.5%, and its expense ratio averaged 0.80% per year. The current expense ratio is 0.45%. Behind the eight ball at the start, the fund falls further behind with each passing year. Your index fund should not be your manager's cash cow. It should be your own cash cow. During the 33 years since 1984, these seemingly small differences added up to a 27% enhancement in value for the Vanguard fund. An original investment of $10,000 grew to $294,900, and the Vanguard 500 index fund, as 2017 began, compared with $232,100 for the Wells Fargo Equity Index Fund. All index funds are not created equal. Intelligent investors will select the lowest cost index funds that are available from reputable fund organizations. Some years ago, a Wells Fargo representative was asked how the firm could justify such high charges. The answer, you don't understand. It's our cash cow. That is, it regularly generates lots of profits for the manager. By carefully selecting the lowest cost index funds for your portfolio, you can be sure that the fund is not the manager's cash cow, but your own. Whether markets are efficient or not, indexing works. Conventional wisdom holds that indexing may make sense in highly efficient corners of the market, such as the S&P 500 for large-cap U.S. stocks, but that active management may have an advantage in other corners of the market, like small-cap stocks or non-U.S. markets. That allegation turns out to be false. As shown in Exhibit 3.3 in Chapter 3, referred to in the accompanying PDF, indexing works perfectly well wherever it has been implemented, as it must. For whether markets are efficient or inefficient, all investors as a group in that segment earn the return of that segment. In inefficient markets, the most successful managers may achieve unusually large returns, but that means some other managers suffered unusually large losses. Never forget that, as a group, all investors in any discrete segment of the stock market must be and are average. International funds also trail their benchmark indexes. International funds are also subject to the same allegation that it is easier for managers to win in, supposedly, less efficient markets. But to no avail. S&P reports that its international index, world markets, less U.S. stocks, outpaced 89% of actively managed international equity funds over the past 15 years. Similarly, the S&P Emerging Markets Index outpaced 90% of emerging market funds. With indexing so successful in both more efficient and less efficient markets alike, and in U.S. markets and global markets, I'm not sure what additional data would be required to close the case in favor of index funds of all types. Caution about gambling. Caution. While investing in particular market sectors is done most efficiently through index funds, betting on one winning sector and then another is exactly that, betting. But betting is a loser's game. Why? Largely because emotions are almost certain to have a powerful negative impact on the returns that investors achieve. Whatever returns each sector may earn, the returns of investors in those very sectors will likely, if not certainly, fall well behind them. There is abundant evidence that the most popular sector funds of the day are those that have recently enjoyed the most spectacular recent performance. As a result, a strategy of trading based on after-the-fact popularity is a recipe for unsuccessful investing. When trying to pick which market sector to bet on, look before you leap. It may not be as exciting as gambling, but owning the traditional stock market index fund at rock-bottom cost is the ultimate strategy. It holds the mathematical certainty that marks it as the gold standard in investing. Try as they might, the alchemists of active management cannot turn their own lead, copper, or iron into gold. Avoid complexity and rely on simplicity and parsimony, and your investments should flourish. Don't take my word for it. You may think that I am too pessimistic in calculating the odds that only 2% of all equity mutual portfolios will outperform the stock market over 50 years. If so, consider the odds calculated by Michael J. Maubuisson, chief market strategist at Credit Suisse, adjunct professor at Columbia Business School, and author of the best-selling More Than You Know. While my 2% estimate would mean that one portfolio in 50 would outperform the stock market over 50 years, Maubuisson calculates the odds of a fund outperforming for 15 years consecutively at 1 in 223,000 and at 1 in 31 million over 21 years. Either way, the odds of outpacing an all-market index fund are, well, terrible. Now listen to Warren Buffett's widely esteemed Berkshire Hathaway partner, Charlie Munger, who eloquently states the case for shunning the foolish complexity of investing and instead opting for simplicity. At large charitable foundations in recent years, there has been a drift toward more complexity. In some endowment funds, there are not few but many investment counselors, chosen by an additional layer of consultants who are hired to decide which investment counselors are best, help in allocating funds to various categories, ensure that claimed investment styles are scrupulously followed, plus a third layer of the security analysts employed by investment banks. There is one thing sure about all this complexity. The total cost of all the investment management, plus the frictional costs of fairly often getting in and out of many large investment positions, can easily reach 3% of foundation net worth per annum. All the equity investors in total will surely bear a performance disadvantage per annum equal to the total croupier's costs they have jointly elected to bear. It is unescapable that exactly half of the investors will get a result below the median result after the croupier's take. A median result that may well be somewhere between unexciting and lousy. The wiser choice is to dispense with the consultants and reduce the investment turnover by changing to indexed investment in equities. Once again, shades of the Gottrocks family. Chapter 14. Bond funds. Where those relentless rules of humble arithmetic also prevail. So far, my application of common sense has been applied largely to the stock market, to equity mutual funds, and to equity index funds. But the relentless rules of humble arithmetic with which I've regaled you also apply, arguably even more forcefully, to bond funds. Perhaps it's obvious why this is so. While a seemingly infinite number of factors influence the stock market and each individual stock that is traded there, a single factor dominates the returns earned by investors in the bond market: the prevailing level of interest rates. Managers of fixed income funds can't do much, if anything, to influence rates. If they don't like the rates established in the marketplace, neither calling the Treasury Department or the Federal Reserve, nor otherwise trying to change the supply-demand equation, is likely to bear fruit. Why would an intelligent investor hold bonds? Over the long term, history tells us that stocks have generally provided higher returns than bonds. That relationship is expected to continue during the coming decade, although rational expectations suggest that future returns both on stocks and on bonds are almost certain to fall well short of historical norms. As noted in Chapter 9, I estimate that annual returns on bonds over the coming decade will average 3.1%. To summarize, since 1900, annual returns on bonds have averaged 5.3%. Since 1974, 8.0%. In the coming decade, likely 3.1%, plus or minus. So, today, why would an intelligent investor hold any bonds at all? First, because the long run is a series of short runs, and during many short periods, bonds have provided higher returns than stocks. In the 117 years since 1900, bonds have outpaced stocks in 42 years. In the 112 five-year periods, bonds have outpaced stocks 29 times. And even in the 103 15-year periods, bonds have outpaced stocks 13 times. Second, and perhaps more important, reducing the volatility of your portfolio can give you downside protection during large market declines, an anchor to windward, so to speak. The conservative nature of a balanced stock-bond portfolio can reduce the possibility of counterproductive investor behavior, that is, getting frightened when the stock market plunges and liquidating your stock position. Third, while bond yields are near their lowest levels since the early 1960s, the current yield on bonds, 3.1%, still exceeds the dividend yield on stocks, 2%. A similar gap between bond yields and stock yields. In fact, that positive yield spread of 1.1 percentage points for bonds over stocks is remarkably close to the 1.4 percentage point yield advantage held by bonds during the recent era. Since 1974, 6.9% average yield on bonds, 5.5% average yield on stocks. So even in this era of low interest rates and low dividend yields, bonds remain relatively competitive. Given these considerations, the question then becomes not why should I own bonds, but what portion of my portfolio should be allocated to bonds? We'll tackle that question in Chapter 18. Bond fund managers track the bond market. As a group, managers of bond funds will almost inevitably deliver a gross return that parallels the baseline constituted by the current interest rate environment. Yes, a few managers might do better, even do better for a long while, by being extra smart or extra lucky, or by taking extra risk. Alas, bad decisions often come home to roost and can impair longer-term returns. Reversion to the mean often strikes. What's more, even if bond managers add a few fractions of 1% to the fund's gross returns, they rarely overcome the fund expenses, fees, and sales loads involved in acquiring their services. Bonds vary in riskiness. While these costs make the task of improving returns far more difficult, overly confident bond fund managers may be tempted to take just a little extra risk by extending maturities of the bonds in the portfolio. Long-dated bonds with, say, 30-year maturities are much more volatile than short-term bonds, say 2 years, but usually provide higher yields. Managers also may be tempted to increase returns by reducing the investment quality of the portfolio. Holding less in U.S. Treasury bonds, rated AA+, or in investment-grade corporate bonds, rated BBB or better, and holding more in below-investment-grade bonds, BB or lower, or even some so-called junk bonds, rated below CC, or even unrated. Heavy reliance on junk bonds to increase the income generated by your portfolio subjects your bond investment to high risks, of course. Investors who seek to increase the yield on their bond portfolios by investing in junk bond funds should limit themselves to small allocations. Caution is advised. Three basic types of bond funds. One beneficial feature of bond mutual funds is that they often offer investors three or more options that deal with the trade-off between return and risk. Short-term portfolios are designed for investors who are willing to sacrifice yield to reduce volatility risk. Long-term portfolios serve investors who want to maximize yield and are prepared to deal with higher volatility. And intermediate-term portfolios seek a balance between income opportunity and market volatility. These options help make bond funds attractive to investors with a variety of strategies. Like stock funds, actively managed bond funds lag their benchmarks. Why? The arithmetic of costs. When all is said and done, bond funds of comparable maturity and credit quality are likely to capture the gross returns of the bond market segments dictated by their policies. And after their expense ratios, operating costs, and sales loads, if any, are deducted, their net returns will fall short. Where bonds are concerned, Brandeis's warning becomes particularly meaningful. Remember, O stranger, arithmetic is the first of the sciences and the mother of safety. There are too many types of bond funds to try your patience by examining the performance of all of them. So, I'll now focus on funds in the three major maturity segments, short, intermediate, and long-term bonds, and two major quality segments, U.S. government and investment-grade corporate bonds. In Chapter 3, I noted that the returns of 90% of actively managed equity mutual funds lagged their benchmark indexes. As reported by S&P in its SPIVA, Standard & Poor's Indices versus Active report. The SPIVA report also compares the returns of bond mutual funds in various categories to their appropriate benchmark indexes. During the 15-year period, from 2001 to 2016, the performance of the bond indexes is also impressive, outpacing an average of 85% of all actively managed bond funds in the six categories, short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term bond funds grouped by both U.S. government and investment-grade corporate sectors. Refer to Exhibit 14.1 in the accompanying PDF. The appropriate indexes also outperformed the managers of municipal bond funds, 84%, and high-yield bond funds, 96%. The important role of costs in shaping bond fund returns. The average shortfall in the returns of intermediate-term and short-term treasury and corporate bond funds relative to index funds during the past 15 years is estimated by SPIVA to be about 0.55% per year. The average bond index fund carried annual costs of about 0.10%, while the expense ratio for actively managed bond funds averaged 0.75%. The average difference in expense ratios came to about 0.65%, slightly larger than the performance gap. Once again, it is clear that low costs account for a dominant portion of the index advantage. The Total Bond Market Index Fund. The first total bond market index fund, formed in 1986 and still the largest, tracks the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. Nearly all of the major all-bond market index funds have followed the leader. These index funds are extremely high in quality, 63% U.S. government-backed bonds, another 5% in AAA-rated corporates, 32% rated AA through BAA, and no bonds rated below investment grade. During the past 10 years, that total bond market index fund earned an annual return of 4.41%, just 0.05 percentage points behind the 4.46% annual return of its target index, a remarkable parallel. Since high-quality portfolios almost always produce lower yields than lower-quality portfolios, the total bond market index fund's yield in mid-2017 is a relatively low 2.5% when compared to the 3.1% yield of the bond market proxy that we used earlier in this chapter. The difference, the bond portfolio that we constructed for this analysis underweighs U.S. government issues, 50%, and overweights investment-grade corporate bonds, 50%, relative to the index, thus producing its higher yield. In order to achieve such a 50-50 government corporate bond portfolio, investors who require a higher yield than the total bond market index fund, yet still seek a high-quality portfolio, might consider a portfolio consisting of 75% in the total bond market index fund and 25% in an investment-grade corporate bond index fund. The value of bond index funds is created by the same forces that create value for stock index funds. The reality is that the value of bond index funds is derived from the same forces that create value in stock index funds. Broad diversification, rock-bottom costs, disciplined portfolio activity, tax efficiency, and focus on shareholders who place their trust in long-term strategies. It is these common-sense characteristics that enable index funds to guarantee that you will earn